parak that we're going to study today. So the parak that we're studying is the eighth parak, just continuing on in order. And Mishlei says as follows. Hashem kanani reshis darko kedem mif'alav me'az. God has acquired me, Torah is speaking. So the Torah says, God has acquired me at the very beginning, before he made any of his creations way back when. A very unusual doctrine, peculiar. Namely, that Torah is not part of creation. Torah existed before there was creation. And it's almost like a paradox, right? Because the only thing, I'm not claiming that we can understand exactly what this means, the only thing that exists before creation is God. Everything else God creates, including us, including the nursing room, including the table, including this whole room, including the book, everything, right? Except, what this pasuk is essentially saying is that the one exception to this rule is Torah. Torah, let's say the values of Torah, love, truth, compassion, these things actually preceded the world. The fancy term for this is primordial, before creation. Torah is primordial. It is not part of creation. It is before creation. The reason I say this is a bit of a paradox is because if God is the only thing that exists before there is creation, God creates, does that mean that Torah is almost like a part of Hashem? Because if Torah exists before creation, and God is the only thing that exists before creation, what does that mean about Torah? So it's very complicated, and this is going to be our subject for today, and I think it will become clear as we go along exactly what Mishlei has in mind. Again, it begins with a very radical doctrine that before there was creation of the world, there was Torah. And this means many, many things, as we'll see. So very poetically, I just want to read another few psukim. Mishlei says, Me'olam nisachti, I was established before the world was, mirosh, from the beginning, mikad me'aretz, before there was even earth. Be'ein telmos cholalti, before there was the depths of the sea, I was established. Be'ein mayanos, nichbani mayim. Okay? Before there was even any oceans or water to speak of. Be'terem harim hatba'u, before the mountains were established. Lifnei Givaos, before there were any hills to speak of, Cholalti. Just a very poetic way of expressing over the number of psukim what Mishlei has in mind, that the Torah is primordial. Before there was any notion of creation of a material world, Torah existed. Okay. So, anybody, let's just pause now to reflect upon this idea for a second, because it's somewhat abstract, so let's try and penetrate it a little bit. What does this mean? Anybody want to jump in? What does it mean that Torah is not part of creation? The Torah precedes. It is a priori. It is prior to creation. What might that mean?
The essence of God.
Okay. I think that...
The essence of God.
Okay. Don, I 1000% agree with you. I think you very succinctly said something that it would have taken me much longer to say. But what exactly do you mean? I think that's excellent.
That everything that... the embodiment of Hashem and everything, all the virtues, all the values, everything that we hold dear about Hashem is the essence of what the Torah is. They're one and the same.
Okay, I think that's excellent. There's a statement of Chazal, Oraisa v'kud shabrichu chad. Oraisa is the Torah, kud shabrichu is God. Chad means one. The Torah and God are one. But what exactly does that mean? So I think it's exactly what Don is saying as follows. One could have said the following. God wanted to create a world for whatever reason. And God did create a world. And then God asked himself, what is the best way for this world to exist? What are the best rules? What's the best playbook? What's the best blueprint for the world? And then given the Torah. The Torah would therefore be a response to the world. The world exists. How are people going to best get along? Let's make a Torah. But that's not what Shlomo envisions. He envisions quite the contrary, the opposite. He's saying is that there was the Torah, meaning the Torah, the ideas and values of God, that existed, and then God said, let me create a world with the purpose purpose of creating a framework for these values to be expressed. I'm intent on creating a forum for these values, the values of peace, of compassion, of love, of truth. And therefore, God creates a material world to express these ideas. These ideas are not some kind of a technical solution to the world's problems. On the contrary, they're the reason for the world's existence. I want to show you a remarkable source. This is in source 3. It will return to the stuff above, but just on this point, it's from the Talmud in Tractate Psachim. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar taught, Ilmale Torah, were it not for the Torah, lo niskaimu shamayim ba'aretz, the world would have never been created. Heaven and earth would never have been created. Shenemar, the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah 33, im lo brisi yomam balayla, were it not for my covenants, my Torah, chukos shamayim ba'aretz lo samti, I would never have established or created the world. In other words, the ideas expressed in the Torah, which Don so correctly put it, are really the values of God, are objectively worthwhile and true. And the world's existence, in this scheme of Mishle and Chazal, is a forum for these values and ideals to be expressed. It's not as if God somehow wanted to create a world and then decided, okay, whatever the Torah is the best way for people to negotiate the world. It's actually quite the opposite. And I think that's a very very important idea. Seal, please go ahead.
I am a little confused. If we talk about the Torah and God being as one, which is what I'm inferring,
correct,
then once the world was created, why was there so much murder and bad stuff going on? The Torah is supposed to be a book of morals and guidance and a directive of how people should live. And if they are one, then somehow missing the point.
Okay, so that's a great question. I think that the real answer is that the Torah expresses God's values, God's ideals. But for the world to be a meaningful place, God had to create a world where there was a possibility that humans would not live up to those ideals. And so humans can and did and have failed.
But they didn't get the Torah until many years
ago. That's true. They didn't get the Torah when we talk about Matan Torah, but let's say the values when we talk about the Torah precedes the world. Right. So the Torah, let's say, the values of the Torah, the values of kindness, the values of peace, these things were already given to Adam and to Noah. It's true that the Jewish people then got a more precise and detailed Torah at Har Sinai. That's certainly true. But the basic values were communicated already to the first man.
And that's why Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are preceding the Torah.
Exactly. Right. So when you use it, so Seal just raises a very good point. So just be very clear. When we say Torah today, what we mean is the broader values, not so much the specific mitzvot that we got at Har Sinai, but let's say the values of truth, of compassion, of peace. These things are innate to the essence of God, as Don pointed out. Therefore, they precede the world. They represent a kind of fundamental unity with God, and God created a material world so that these values could be expressed. And not the opposite. It wasn't that God wanted to create a world and then asked himself, well, what will the best way for the world to operate be? That's a very important difference. It's an abstract and philosophical difference, but it's a very important difference in terms of the philosophy of what Torah is. Now, I wanted just to read the last two verses here, because they draw on this image of the childhood friend that I think is so important. If it's really correct what we're saying, that Hashem and the Torah, quote-unquote, meaning God's values, preceded creation, meaning before there was anything else, then the image of Mishle comes very clear. So the Torah says, V'ahayah etzlo amon, I was with him in nursery school. V'ahayah shashuim. Shashuim means like a childhood friend, like Hashem says about the Jewish people. Im yelad shashuim, right? Havein yakir li Ephraim. Im yelad shashuim, right? It was like my delight, the child of my delight. I was playing with Hashem yom yom, misafeket lefanav bechol ei. I was playing in front of God at all times. In other words, what the Torah is describing was, well, there was nothing else going around. You know, this was the infancy of creation, so to speak. And so the only entities were God, and again, I put it in quotation marks, because the Torah is really just an expression of God's ideals, and the Torah. So Mishlei is creating a very beautiful image of, you know, in their infancy, so to speak, God and the Torah are playing with each other. They're having a nice time. We're going to return at the very end of this year. We're going to come back to this image of God being playful. But Mishlei is imagining a scene where God's, you know, in nursery school. You know, the world's rather young. Creation is rather young. And God and the Torah are hanging out. They're playing jacks, you know, or stoop ball, or, you know, or both. You know, there was time for both. Because the world wasn't around, the God wasn't busy yet. Again, at the very end of this year, we're going to come back to this notion that even God likes to have a good time, even God needs to play around. This is a very important idea. We're just going to come back to that at the end. Okay, so what Shlomo HaMelech is trying to accomplish here is just to try and express in a poetic way this distinction between Torah and the rest of creation. Torah, because it really does reflect God's essence, should not be considered part of the creation of the world. When God decided to create the world and introduce the dimensions of space and time, that's the creation of the world. But before that, there was Hashem and Hashem's eternal values. And Torah is not a response to the world. Torah precedes the world. It is a reflection of God's values. I want to use this insight to look at source 4 and to explain a very difficult Mishnah, a somewhat famous Mishnah. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says as follows. Chamisha kinyanim, there were five acquisitions. A kinyan is an acquisition. Niknot is to buy. But we're going to see that term, that translation doesn't really do justice. Chamisha kinyanim, kana HaKadosh Baruch Hu be'olamo. There were five acquisitions which God had in his world. Ve'eluhem, and these were them. Torah, Kinyan Echad. Torah was one acquisition. Shamayim Ba'aretz, heaven and earth, Kinyan Echad. Heaven and earth are another acquisition. So actually, Stanley, do you mind counting for us? So there's Torah. Okay. Who wants to count? Torah is one. Shamayim Ba'aretz is two. Abraham, Kinyan Echad. Abraham is three. Yisrael Kinyan Echad, the Jewish people are the fourth Kinyan. Beis HaMikdash Kinyan Echad. Beis HaMikdash is the fifth. Beis HaMikdash is the fifth and final Kinyan. So what does it mean that God? It's a very troubling Mishnah, very challenging. What does it mean that God has five acquisitions? I mean, especially. What about Yitzhak?
Israel.
What about right? And Israel here. Right, what about Moshe? What about, right, and especially if one of them is the whole world, so then that of course will include everything in it. So it doesn't seem to make any sense. If one of God's acquisitions is the whole world, how could you have any other acquisition? And like Irving asked correctly, what about Yitzhak? What about Moshe? What about David? Why just Abram? Yeah.
Why does he skip Yitzhak?
We have Abraham, and then we have Yisrael, which in this case means Am Yisrael. In this case, it means Am Yisrael. But your point is still very well taken, which is why not Yitzchak? Why not David? Why not Moshe? What does Kinyan really mean here? So obviously, Kinyan doesn't really mean acquisition, because then it wouldn't be sensible. Because if we're talking about what God owns, then God owns everything. God created everything. So Kinyan here is not, it can't be translated as acquisition or what falls under God's ownership. Then you have a whole slew of problems.
Why?
So, what's that?
Why?
Because
Kinyan can mean different things at different times.
It certainly does. So what we're, exactly, and you
are...
Exactly, that's acquire. So acquire better. So your name is... What should I call you?
Chanowitz.
Mrs. Chanowitz. Okay. So Mrs. Chanowitz raises a very good question, which is why can't Kenyan mean to acquire or that which God owns, because God owns everything. The answer is because exactly. So how could you have a list of only five things? It should be everything, especially since one of the five things is heaven and earth entirely. Once you establish that, there's not room for anything else. So who wants to suggest a different translation for Kenyan here? And I'm going to show you how the normal translation of Kenyan is actually symptomatic of this deeper meaning of the term. Normally we use Kenyan to acquire something. It's a certain kind of relationship which is established between owner and object. But I think what Kenyan really means here is there are five extensions, so to speak, of God in this world. Five reflections of God's essence. Five extensions of Him. The reason that we use the term Kenyan for an acquisition is because there's a very close relationship which is generated between an owner and an object. So much so that the object can sometimes appear to be an extension of the person. I'll give you an example. Let's say Stanley drives a convertible. Right, so when people will see the convertible, they'll say, ah, it's Stanley's car. The car, the object, becomes like an extension of the owner. But the real term, Kenyan, does not mean merely to acquire. It means to really develop an extension. And that's why we use it for objects. That's also why we use it in the language of marriage. We say that we talk about a Kenyan kiddushin, the man acquires the wife. Does the man buy the wife? Absolutely not. This is not, she's not a car. She's not a piano. You can't buy her. What it means that if man is performing the Kenyan on the wife, it means that they are becoming extensions of each other. So I think that is actually the proper meaning of this Mishnah. So let's go back and I think... Mechir Eschametz is a regular Kenyan. That's when you're just divesting yourself of ownership. Exactly. So if you take a look at the Mishnah, I think it reads perfectly. Now, if you go back to source 4, Chamisha Kenyanim Kana Kadosh Baruch Hu Bi'olamo. There are really five extensions of God in this world. The Eluhain, Torah. The first one is Torah. The Torah itself is an extension of God. As Don said, it captures His essence. It reflects His values. The Torah bears God's hallmark. It's not just a response to the world. As we said, it precedes the world. The next Kenyan is Shamayim Ba'aretz, heaven and earth, creation itself, in all of its complexity, in its multiplicity, down to the smallest atom and the single cell organism, and to the cosmos at large. That itself reflects God's majesty, His creativity, and His essence. Kenyan Echad Abraham, more than any other person, even more than Moshe, Avram acted as the quintessential agent, the extension of God. He brought the concept of monotheism into the world at large.
He was the first
Jew. In a certain sense, yes. He was in fact father of many nations, but he really acted as the God's extension in this world. The pioneer and the innovator of monotheism. He uniquely is the extension of God in this world. That's why even Moshe, who was the greatest individual who ever lived, but who had a different mission, doesn't make the list. Because Kenyan here means extension or reflection of. Avram reflected and extended God's message into this world by introducing monotheism. Yisrael, Am Yisrael Kenyan Echad. The Jewish people, by virtue of their unique mission, serve as an extension of God in this world. They are His people who bear His message. That's a tremendous responsibility. We've suffered a lot for that. But that's the reality. And then Beis HaMikdash is the geographical extension of God's essence. That's the Shekhinah, the place where the Shekhinah rests. So these five categories are not acquisitions. They're not that which is owned by God. That would be absurd. Everything is owned by God. What they really are extensions of God, each in their own way. And I think it's a very deep mission in that sense. But I want to take it just one step further. Can anybody discern something in the sequence, in the chronology of this Mishnah? The Mishnah lists five things. Is it just haphazard, or is there a particular sequence?
Just the order that you set things up.
Perfect. I got exuberant. Yes. No, go ahead, Don.
It's the order of events. It's chronologically from the Torah first, part of the essence, then the creation of the world, then Adam was the first, then with monotheism. Remember what you said, Israel spawns from Abraham years later, and the temple is the manifestation of the Jewish people's wish to have a place to worship.
Exactly. So this is actually following, according to the sages, the chronological order. It works out beautifully. Before there is Shamayim Ba'aretz, which is extension of God number two, what comes before that? There's Torah. That's completely consistent with what Mishle said, Adonai Kanani Reshis Darko Kedem Yifalav Me'az. Before there was ever any material creation, before there was heaven or earth, there was a kind of ideal representation of God. And the ideal representation of God was the Torah, the notion of God's values, which were given to human beings in the form of the Torah. But that existed before there was Shemayim Ba'aretz. Then we moved to Shemayim Ba'aretz. Then God chose to reflect himself not only in the ideal Torah, but in a material creation, in heaven and earth. Down to the smallest atom, the proton, the neutron, the electron, down to the cell and the nucleus, and in the vast spaces as well, in the stars, etc. Then there was Abraham. Before there was ever a Jewish people, there was Abraham, who introduced the notion of God, the unified, one true God, creator of heaven and earth, and all-powerful God, to the world. Then there was Israel, the Jewish people, which was God's one nation. And then there was the temple. So it actually follows a very precise order. Now, the Mishnah goes on to say, the Mishnah proves it. So what does it mean that the Torah is an extension or a reflection of God? Torah kinyan echad minayin. How do we know this? It says the Mishnah. Dichsiv, as the verse says, and which verse do they pick? Our verse from Mishle, the 8th chapter, Adonai Kanani Reshis Darko Kedem Nifalav Me'az. God has acquired me, namely God has injected his essence into the Torah, because the Torah reflects God values. God is peace, God is truth, God is compassion, etc., etc. And those that forms the spine, the framework of the Torah, before there was any creation altogether. Okay, so I think that this is a very important idea about how the Torah is really an extension of God's ultimate essence. And in that sense, the Torah really does precede the world, just as God himself precedes the world. The Torah is not just a response to the world, or the best way of managing in the world, or some kind of a book of technical solutions to the world's problems. It is that, but more profoundly, it is a reflection of God's essence, and therefore it has intrinsic meaning beyond the significance of the world. Okay, that's a very important philosophical stand that Judaism took. I want to move one step further to dwell on this image of God delighting in the Torah. Mishle said that Hashem's childhood friend, the one, to use Bella's poignant expression, the one that he delighted in, the one that he was intimate with, was the Torah, because there was nothing else. It was just God and, so to speak, his Torah. And the verse that said that, v'ya'etzlo amon, I was with him when I was nursing, this is in source 5, v'ya'esha'ashu'im yom yom, and we delighted with each other every single day, and I played with him at every moment. God delighted in the Torah, meaning that God, whatever this means, took pleasure in the values of the Torah. God took pleasure in truth, in compassion, in love. These values were a source of pleasure for God. It made him happy. And then Mishle goes on to conclude this section with the following charge. Misacheket b'tevel artzo, the end goal is for even those who dwell on earth to rejoice in the Torah. V'sha'ashuai es b'nei Adam. Torah says, yes, I once only delighted Hashem. I once only brought Hashem joy, but that was before there was a world. But now I have a new ambition. Once the world and humans have been created, now I would like to serve as a delight, not just for God, but for b'nei Adam, for Yoshvei Tevel. I think this is a very important idea, namely that our challenge is not just to embrace the values of Torah, that the broader cardinal values, the values of peace, justice, truth, love, compassion, we should be delighted in them. That's what Mishle is saying. Torah doesn't only want to be a guide for us, but a source of delight, v'sha'ashuai, a playmate, a friend. One can respect the set of laws, but one need not love it. One need not delight in it. One need not find joy in it. What we're being asked is much more ambitious than simply being told to respect the Torah or to embrace the Torah. We're being told to delight in it. That's a very high bar. I wouldn't say that I fit into that category. But was that?
It's a beautiful concept.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful concept that we're supposed to treat Torah as a childhood friend.
An example was set by.
By God, exactly. So that's a very...
meaning. I'll ask that question. What are the three things when you come up to the El Ha'emes?
Uh-huh.
One of them is the source of Emunah, in other words.
What is that? Sorry?
Did you deal honestly?
Who said this? Where is this?
Chazal.
It's in the Talmud in Sabbath, in Tractate Sabbath 31a, is Mrs. Chanowitz's citation. There are six questions that God asks a person when they get to the celestial realm.
First one
was, were you honest in business? Asafta be'emunah. The second one is, kavata itim l'Torah. Did you study Torah? I just can't help myself. You'll forgive me. Notice that God asks, were you honest in business, before he asks whether you studied Torah. In other words, it's better to be honest in business, okay? If you're not going to be honest in business, it's cornish that you study Torah. It's not worth anything. Okay, so the first question is you have to be honest in business. Second question is did you study the Torah? Then there's a whole list of questions. It's asakta vipirya viribya. Did you procreate? Were you fruitful? Meaning, if you could. It doesn't mean that everybody has to. And then there's a question of tzipisa li Yeshua. Did you wait for salvation? There's a whole litany of questions there. So, in any
your question is to enjoy my world.
Yeah, so that is the famous question of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. It's based on the Yerushalmi. This is not found in the standard Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud Bavli, which is our, normally when we use the Talmud, but there's something called the Palestinian Talmud, which was not written in Gaza or the West Bank. It's the Palestinian Talmud because there was no Israel then. So it's the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi says at the very end of the tractate Rosh Hashanah, it says that when you get to heaven, this is what Mrs. Chanowitz is referring to, God says to you, I'm holding you to account for all the things in the world that I wanted you to enjoy and you didn't enjoy. Sometimes people think that everything in the world is forbidden unless God explicitly says it's permissible. And the world is basically a minefield. It's a spiritual minefield. And God's just waiting for you to step on a landmine to explode and kill yourself. So the best way to go around the world is to tiptoe and not do anything wrong. And that way, when you get to heaven, you're going to pass. But what Mrs. Chandler is saying is the opposite. It's that God said, you have to enjoy the world, and I'm going to hold you to account for all the things that you should have enjoyed that you didn't enjoy. So that's why in many centuries after the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Palestinian Talmud, a figure named Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, from Frankfurt, Germany, when he went to visit the Alps. Now for him, it wasn't such a big trip. If you go to visit the Alps, that'll set you back a few $1,000 if you're leaving from New York. If you're leaving from Frankfurt, you just have to go south, okay? You go a little bit south, and you're ready in the Bavarian Alps, and then you're in Switzerland in no time. So I don't know if Shimshon Raphael Hirsch would have said this if he lived in New York, but he lived in Frankfurt, so it wasn't his problem. So he said, I have to go see the Alps, because God's going to ask me when I get to heaven, what do you think of my Alps? Shimshon, what do you think of my Alps? And I'm going to say, I didn't see them. So God's going to say, why didn't you? Well, my Alps weren't good enough for you. You made something better. So the idea is that you're supposed to delight in creation. Now what we're seeing here is, just as one is supposed to delight in the world, we have an even higher standard that we're supposed to delight in the Torah. V'sha'ashuai es b'nei adam. Turn the Torah into a childhood friend. The one that when you see them, it's like Bella said, there's intimacy. It's one thing for God and the Torah to be childhood friends. They really were. They were hanging out when nobody else was around. But Shlomo HaMelech turns the tables on us and he says, you have to aspire to that. You have to make Torah your childhood friend. You have to not just do it, but enjoy it. Love it. Play with it. It should be your delight. David HaMelech is the only person I know who achieved this, really. He says, Lule Torascha Sha'ashuai. If it were not for the Torah, my delight as avati b'oniyah, then I would have been lost. I would have never, David HaMelech had many tzaras in his life. He's what in Yiddish would be called gehafta tzaras. He had a lot of problems. His son rebelled against him, and he had all kinds of problems before that with Shaul, when before he was king. And then after that, he was like I said, he was rebelled, he was overthrown by his own son, and then he had wars to fight, and he had trouble with his wives. David HaMelech had a lot of problems in his life. But he said the one thing that gave him a lot of delight and comfort is Lule Torascha Sha'ashuai, my delight. So, in any event, what Sefer Mishlei is saying is that just as Hashem, at one primordial point, delighted in the Torah, Ve'yetzvo Amon, Ve'yeshashuim Yom Yom, Misacheket Lefanav Bechol Eis, the goal is, Misacheket Spetevil Arzo, Torah says, I want to, just like I was childhood friends with God, now that God gave me over to man, now I want to make friends with man. I want to delight man to delight in me, v'shashuai es b'nei Adam. Again, this is a very, very high standard. It's something to aspire to. I don't think this type of thing is accomplished overnight. But again, the ideal here is to delight in the Torah. I think this is so important because I'm not very good at this, but I'll just say that I aspire to it, which is that there are people who are really, really happy. They're lighthearted and fun and full of energy and just very upbeat, and that's an amazing quality. And then sometimes what happens is the more people take Torah seriously and all of the values encoded in the Torah, you see it kind of weighing them down, which is understandable. There are a million rules, and it kind of can wear on a person and grind out the joy. But what Mishlei is saying is it doesn't have to be that way. It shouldn't be that way. Is that one's embracing Torah and every jot and tittle, even the small parts, that there should be no contradiction between that and a sense of esprit de corps and a certain joy in life. And that's a good way to express it.
I have
Bella, please.
I have a grandson in Yerushalayim.
Yes.
And he learns Torah Yom Balayla, and his face shines when he talks about Torah. But when he gives shiurim, I mean, he's delighting in the Torah.
Yes. So he fulfills this pasuk. V'shashuai es b'nei Adam. The Torah says, I want the people to delight in me. Right. Not just to do me, not just, but to delight in me. It's an
wonderful thing.
It's amazing, right?
It's just wonderful.
Why do you say you love this fire too? You love it.
But I wouldn't say that I'm on the level of Bella's grandson. That's a much higher level. So I'm just saying that this is an amazing thing. That there should be no contradiction between a person who has amazing joy and a person who embraces the Torah. And the role model, as Don said so correctly, the role model that we have for this is God. Is that, you know, way back when, before God had to worry about collecting taxes and, you know, and the weather. Think about how much time that takes. You got to have to control the weather. You know, before there was any weather to worry about because there was no world, God could just delight in the Torah. That's kind of our role model. We're supposed to make the Torah our childhood friend. Now, in light of all this discussion about, you know, it's a beautiful image of God and the Torah as kids playing around and having fun, I just wanted to share with you one of my favorite Gemaras in all of the Talmud Bavli, because it also highlights this idea of Hashem taking time out of his day to have fun. The importance of having fun. Okay. So the Talmud in Masachs Avodah Zarah, in Tractate Avodah Zarah, asks a very simple question. They want to know what God's itinerary is. You know, God is obviously very, very busy. As we said, well, what's God's itinerary? What does he do every day? I mean, he has so many things to do. Like we said, he has to control the weather. He has to deal with all the people who are complaining, why do you do this, why do you do that? It's a very busy day. So how does he organize it all? So that's the question that the Talmud wanted to know. So the Talmud asked the following question. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda taught in the name of Rav. God maintains a 12-hour day. Okay? Even God doesn't work more than 60 hours a week. I'm assuming he takes the weekends off. Maybe not. I don't know. So,
clothing from here?
Yeah, this is source 6. Oh, Stan, can you just show Mr. Penowitz where to look? Okay, Rav Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Shteim Esrei Sha'os Havi Hayom. There are 12 hours in God's work schedule. Shalosh HaRishonos, the first three, let's say, for argument's sake, God starts the day at 8. So from 8 to 11, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yoshev Osek B'Torah. God is a Chavrusa. With whom? We don't know. God is a Chavrusa. He sits and he learns Torah. Shnios, the second third of the day, so let's say from 11 to 2, Yoshev B'Dan Es Kol HaOlam Kulo. He has to sit in judgment. So he sits on the bench, and he sees everybody's lying, and everybody's stealing, and everybody's cheating their friends, and everybody's doing terrible things. So he has to judge, and everybody gets an F. So Kevan Shirash, and he's Chayim Olam Kliya. Once you see that, you know, in truth he should be destroying the world every day, that's then 2 o'clock comes around. So at 2 o'clock, God gets off the chair of judgment. Omeid Mikisei Hadin. He gets up and he leaves the chair of judgment, which he sat in for the second 3 hours of the day. V'yoshev al kisei rachamim. So God says, forget it, I'm just going over to the chair of mercy. So from 2 to 5, he sits in the chair of mercy, and every verdict that he wrote up for everybody who from 11 to 2 saying, you're guilty, he rips it up from 2 to 5. So he spends from 2 to 5 on doing what he did from 11 to 2. So just to review so far, from 8 to 11, God was studying Torah. From 11 to 2, he was sitting in court writing traffic tickets. And from 2 to 5, he was ripping up the traffic tickets. Okay. Shlishios, Yoshev Vizan Es Kol HaOlam Kulo, Mikarne Re'emi Ma'beitze Kinim. Then in the third part of the day, God has to feed people. He's also in charge of world hunger. So it says that God feeds the world and gives very special kinds of foods. The horns of rams and the eggs of lice. Now I admit it doesn't sound too appetizing, but by the time it gets down to the world, it's pretty good. So then God has to deal with world hunger. So far we've seen God studying Torah, beginning his day. Then God has a judicial function. And then God, you know, he's got to solve world hunger. So you have to admit, he's accomplished a lot in the course of the day. He studied a lot of Torah, he's sat in judgment of the world and managed to get everybody off the hook, and he's fed the whole world. So by the end of the day, the final quadrant, Revios, Yoshev Umesachik Im Livyasan. God winds down and he hangs out with the Livyasan, the Leviathan. The Leviathan, according to the tradition of Chazal, was like, you know, sort of God's playmate. We learned about the Torah as God's playmate, but the Leviathan was like part of an earlier world, so to speak, and God hangs out with his buddy the Leviathan, and either presumably they watch sports or whatever other activities they do, the crossword. Yoshevu Misachik Im Leviathan Shenemar Leviathan Zeh Yatzarta Misachik Bo. The Leviathan was created to be God's friend. Now Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out that just as we have to emulate God in all of the more grave attributes, the more serious attributes that we learn, how do we know we have to be compassionate people? The Talmud says in Sota, God is compassionate, you have to be compassionate. Mahu rachum apata rachum. Mahu chanun, just as God is gracious, apata chanun. Just as God takes care of the sick, you have to take care of the sick. Just as God visits those who are mourning, Menachem Avelim, he comforts those who are mourning, you do, etc., etc. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, and this also, just as God knows how to laugh and have an upbeat demeanor, so too people have to cultivate that. And if you don't cultivate that aspect of your personality, then you're not complete. This is also part of the mandate of Imitatio Dei, of Velachta Bidracha, the importance of taking joy and delight and laughter in the world, knowing how to laugh at things, knowing how to be mellow, and that way to emulate God from this important section of the Talmud. It's not just enough to have Ivdu Es Hashem B'Yira, but we need the Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha as well. One has to aspire to serve God with a real joy. So just to review what we saw, we noted that the Pasuk in Mishlei makes a very bold statement, that Torah is not part of creation. There's an entire creation of the material world, the heaven and the earth, the oceans, the mountains, and everything contained therein, all the animal life, all the plant life, all human beings. But Torah is not part of that. In fact, says Mishlei, Hashem Kanani Rishis Darko, Hashem and Torah go back all the way before creation. But what could that mean, we asked. After all, the only thing which can precede creation is God himself. So it must mean that Torah is some kind of an extension of God. As Chazal say, Oraisa v'kutcher b'ichu chad, the Torah and God are one. Meaning the Torah is nothing other than a teaching of God's essence. All of the values contained in the Torah are in fact the values of God. The values of truth, of compassion, of justice, and of love. And once one understands that, one can well understand what Mishlei means when he says that these values preceded the world just as God himself preceded the world. Then God went ahead and created the world for the sake of creating a forum in which human beings could learn and express these values. That was the great experiment that the world was. The world is really an experiment to see, can man learn about these values, internalize them, and bring them to bear in the real world? That's the whole nature of the game. And as Seal pointed out, most of the time we fall short. Most of the time we don't really succeed at internalizing those values and demonstrating them on the world stage. But that was God's project, to create a world to see if human beings could actually internalize and express the values of the Torah, God's own values. That's why the secret to all of Jewish ethics is that we have to imitate God. That's what the Torah is. It's just an encapsulation of God's values. We pointed out that this is exactly the plain meaning of a passage in the Talmud Himsachim. The Talmud says, were it not for the Torah, God would have never created the world. In other words, it wasn't that God decided to create a world and then said, well, how are people going to manage? Let me give them a Torah. It was quite the opposite. There was Torah, namely a statement, a mission statement of God's values. And God created the world to see whether people would be able to internalize and express these values. That's exactly what the Talmud and Tzachim had in mind. We then said that the Mishnah and Avos expresses the idea that there are five kinyanim of God in the world. What could this mean? God only has five acquisitions? The rest belongs to the unions? The rest belongs to the government? The rest belongs to Bill Gates? Most of it, but not everything. So what could the Mishnah... Yeah, so what could the Mishnah possibly mean? So he answered that kinyanim here doesn't mean that God owns only five things. It means that God's essence is really expressed in five ways. The first way, before there was even Shemayim Ba'aretz, was the Torah. Then there was creation itself, where God expressed himself through the material and physical world in all of its beauty and majesty. Then there was Abraham, who brought God's essence, the fact that God was unified and in control, into the world. Then there was the Jewish people. God tied his fate to that of the Jewish people. When the Jewish people are down, God is down. When Jewish people are up, God is up. And then there was the Beis HaMikdash, God's chosen geographical location. That's basically a summary of the idea that we're developing, namely that Torah itself was an expression of God's values. We then moved to the next segment, which was to say that Shlomo portrayed the Torah and God, which exists before creation, as being the closest of childhood friends. They delighted in each other. And then gave all of us the challenge to develop that kind of relationship with Torah. Again, it's a very high bar. It's not merely that we should try to keep the Torah or execute its mission, but that we should really be brought to places of joy by doing chesed, be brought to places of joy by being honest, by being just, by doing the right thing. It's a very, very hard thing to do, because we also have a Yetzer Hara, which gives us joy from doing the opposite. But this is the challenge, to develop that kind of childhood friendship with Torah, where we feel an intimacy towards it, we feel a delight in it, a kind of very easygoing, playful relationship with Torah. And then we just took a step back and said, isn't it interesting that Mishlei can present God as having a childhood friend, as playing around? It's such an unusual perspective on God. We normally think about God as, you know, much more grave. We think about him as much more serious or severe. The idea of God playing with a childhood friend is a very lighthearted, beautiful image, but a surprising one. But we took a step back and we said, in fact, that's exactly what the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says. True, God studies the Torah. True, God sits in judgment of the world and then tears up the judgments. True, God is in charge of world hunger. But then also God makes time to play with his friends. And that's a very important message for us also. It's not enough to be grave. One all has to cultivate a certain sense of delight. Well, the Yatsen, exactly, Leviathan is the
special.
Yeah, so what Mrs. Chanowitz is pointing out is that one of the traditions, there are many beautiful, beautiful traditions that we have regarding Leviathan. So the Leviathan is a fish, and the Talmud says that it's going to be one of the foods which are fed to the righteous in the world to come. So there's a joke that I have to tell, a joke that I heard from my father. I hope people don't mind, but in the spirit of delighting and expressing
the
light, the light, exactly, that's what this Gemara is saying. I'm actually fulfilling the Gemara. Thank you. That's what I like to think. So, you know, sometimes when people aren't sure whether the meat, let's say from a cow, is kosher, so they order the fish. So again, the passage in the Talmud says that when the righteous get to heaven, in the next world, they're going to eat fish. They're going to eat the Leviathan. So the old Yiddish joke goes, well, why are they eating the fish? Well, why don't they have meat? Why don't they have a steak? Why are they eating fish? So the answer that the Yiddish joke gives is because they didn't trust the Avisher Shchita. They didn't, when the righteous people got to heaven, they didn't rely on God's kashrus. They said, you know, we're not so sure this guy. So when they get upstairs, they don't want to have meat. It could be tricked, so they have the fish.
It's true.
They have the fish. That's the old joke about why Mrs. Chapman's pointing out why they said that the righteous will be served fish in the world to come. They don't trust it. Now, the truth is, the joke's not such an accurate joke, because it does the Torah, the Talmud does go on to say that there will be eating from oxen as well. So at least there will be a group of righteous people. They will be eating from the shore of Bor. There will be eating from oxen as well. So apparently there will be some righteous people who feel comfortable relying on God's kashrus organization. Yeah. So okay. So that's just an important thing to be aware of.
But does the Talmud describe the size of one of the oxen?
Not to my knowledge. I think it was large. It has to be large enough to sustain, you know, a goodly amount of tzaddikim. So again, the real point here is that, you know, whether God's playing with the fish or not. The idea is that Hashem values the idea of levity in the right place, and that's an important characteristic to cultivate. I think that if I could just reflect on this for a moment, joy gets a bad rap because we sometimes associate it with negative things like frivolity or crossing the line or having fun at somebody else's expense. But we have to remind ourselves that that's actually quite different than joy and laughter, and that there's perfectly legitimate joy and laughter. And sometimes I think what happens is the baby and the bathwater get thrown out together, because sometimes levity and joy can easily lead to lines being crossed. People forswear just really having appropriate laughter and good times with family and friends. And that you have to be very, very careful about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. This is, I think, a major issue in religious life, is that it becomes very quickly very grave. And we just have to be very cautious about that, because there's something I don't even know if I can articulate it. But when one is sitting with a close friend or a family member and just joking around, there's something very sanctified about that, and very precious, and the whole, very spiritual. And it's a totally different way of coming to know God than simply being serious. And I think that's exactly what the Gemara is trying to express, is to be a complete person, one has to be able to express that kind of mirth, that kind of joy. And one has to be wise to know how to draw the line and make sure that one, you know, isn't crossing boundaries and having fun at other people's expense, but it's really doing it in the right way. I just wanted to conclude in 1 minute that I have left with a story, a beautiful story that I heard this past year from one of the Rosh Yeshiva, a man named Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Moshe Tendler. So Rabbi Tendler's father-in-law was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was a rabbi from Russia who came to the United States, and he lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and he had a small yeshiva there, but what really made him famous was not his role as a teacher, as the head of the yeshiva, but he actually helped answer lots of halachic questions. He was what was called a posek. He was a halachic decisor. And he was known not just for his incredible erudition, but for his fine personality, and his humanity, and really one of the great leaders of the Jewish people in the 20th century, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. I never saw him because he passed away literally right when I was being born, but I think people say he was like about 5'2", so a very little man. And
I knew him very well.
So can you test about a small man? A giant in a small package, right. The greatest, yeah. I can just tell you in rabbinical school.
My father was a Chaim Lubavitch, very frightening.
Oh,
he was Rabbi Feinstein, you know Rabbi Engel, and my father.
That's so nice.
There was a shiloh, even in the middle of the night, they started taking an opinion of Halacha, and the decision came from Rabbi Feinstein, Rabbi Engel, and my father.
Okay, that's beautiful.
It's a different world.
It's beautiful, so we have fans.
We
lived in the Lower East Side for a short period of time.
From Chaim Ritz. That I knew from Irving. That I was very impressed by. So, right, Moshe Feinstein, it said he's a European Jew. And he had a very dear friend, very dear childhood friend, named Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. They didn't call each other, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky or Moshe Feinstein, they called him Moshe and Rabbi Yaakov. But, Rabbi Tamler was telling us that when they used to get together every year on Chol Hamoed Sukkos, Rabbi Feinstein and Rabbi Kamenetsky, this is when they were well into their twilight years, let's say. He said they used to sit for hours. They weren't even learning Torah. They would just sit and giggle, he said, like little boys. They would just sit in there and telling each other stories and reminding each other of memories from home, decades and decades and decades ago. And they would sit and laugh, he said, like little boys for hours. Then he would go in and check on them and like try to listen, like what are they laughing about? Or like, you know, what are they learning? And they were just laughing, telling stories. And the reason that really struck a chord is because, you see, this is part of being a full personality, is developing that space in life where just to be able to laugh and tell stories in a wholesome way and to be able to experience that in life. And I think that's the plain sense of this Gemara and the plain sense of even describing Hashem, you know, however absurd this sounds, Hashem is rejoicing and taking pleasure either in the Torah itself. That's what Mishle was talking about. That Hashem's childhood friend was the Torah. They used to play together. Or in the parlance of the Gemara, that Hashem was playing with his friend Leviathan. It's about developing that quality. Okay.